From Pip Walsh. Pip is the CEO of Greening Australia New South Wales, and she'll be talking about climate adaptation activities from that organisation. Thanks, Pip.
Can you stand there or just push the forward here?
I might stand here. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Probably a little bit of a different one, because as Greening Australia, we're obviously not primarily a research organisation. We're a not-for-profit organisation that was essentially set up to help people with plant-based conservation. We've got about 200 staff located across all states. We were established in the year of the tree, essentially to help people plant trees. We have moved on a little bit from that. Strictly apolitical. What I call a very practical organisation. So, of the staff in Greening Australia, I don't know, probably in excess of 160 of them, you engage them most actively on discussion of new machinery for killing weeds, new herbicide applications, new machinery for planting things, the use of seed cuttings. They're very practically oriented, and they're also what I call very partnership oriented. Again, a lot of them work very strongly with local landowners, local councils, local CMAs, that type of thing. Probably the other thing, which I just put there on the board, so I thought it's an interesting one, we're increasingly what I call commercially oriented, which is we're very sensitive to how much it costs to do the work we need to do. And we're very focused on thinking about how do we reduce the cost, but I think we've started to realise that that's one of the primary issues we face, because we've been a really busy organisation. We've got some quite impressive statistics about the number of trees, the number of hectares, the number of landowners. So we feel like we're a busy organisation, but as you start looking at climate change and the issues of adaptation, and we say what role does Greening Australia or Landcare or other similar organisations which are doing things on the ground have to play, you need to keep asking what's our impact? Is our impact likely to be sufficient? And you look at pictures of landscapes like these and you start saying to yourself, maybe it's not enough. How do we actually change that? What do we need to do to change that? And I've put up this diagram just to think about it, because I think in terms of the environment movement and perhaps where it's been positioned over the last, say, 40 or 50 years, it's had a really strong focus on what I call the green line, the protect line, which is about saying how do we actually protect things, how do we get them into a tenure we believe will protect them. There's been, I think, increasing effort on the blue line, which I call manage, which is actually then actively managing things you've protected, dealing with threats. And then the red line I've used for restoration. I think the current trajectory for that is still quite slow in comparison with the other issues. My own person, and this is a little bit of my own personal view. My personal view is, in a sense, protect. We will have protected a lot of the existing vegetation at some point in the not too distant future. There'll be work to do. There's increasing work on management. But I think the big work, and this is particularly for Greening Australia, is to try and lift that trajectory of restoration, because that's really, I think, one of the key things we need to be doing in the face of climate change. And I think Leslie pointed that out when you had your three different areas of activity. So particularly for Greening Australia, we're focused on things like addressing threats, but we're also focused on how do we actually increase resilience or increase the area. Not to say that we're recreating these ecosystems. I think our view on that would be that may take several centuries or perhaps even millennia. We may put back some of the structure that enables that to happen. So really, climate change has increased the urgency of our agenda, but perhaps not some of the basic things we're looking at. And I think that's one of our real questions is, has it changed the basic things we believe we need to do? And that's a big research question. But we definitely know it's increased the urgency. One of the things we did when we reached 25 years was we realised that we'd been very responsive to people. We're very much an organisation. People would call us, and at that point we were still largely funded through government programs, and we would run and help them. We had a lot of technical expertise around vegetation. But then, unfortunately, happened to coincide with perhaps there's a dramatic decrease in government funding as things like CMAs were set up. We also started saying, well, hang on, we actually need to measurably improve ecological health. And we said, perhaps we're not going to be doing that across all of Australia, but we're actually going to now start saying we're going to focus on areas, we're going to look at places where we've been, we're going to pick 50 landscapes. We haven't picked all 50 yet, but we've got about 14 where we'd say we've got land across Australia, we've got landscapes where we've got a body of work, and we've started to think seriously about what is needed for their long-term viability and what role Greening Australia plays, along with other institutions in those landscapes, to make that happen. Part of doing this has been taking a much more focused approach to how we actually plan our work. And we've really taken something which has been used by an organisation called the Nature Conservancy for some time, called Conservation Action Planning. And in fact, it's now mutating into something which is called the Open Standards for Conservation, which is a methodology for thinking about large-scale planning, largely by NGOs, so organisations like WWF, African Wildlife Foundation, TNC, Bush Heritage Australia, Greening Australia, and many others, have started saying, let's actually think about having a way of thinking about our projects, thinking about them in scale, and thinking about them in a way where we can actually, over time, talk about them and compare how we're doing in those landscapes. So we've started to set up what you might almost call the sort of Rosetta Stone, so that, you know, I had a question from a researcher in the States wanting to ask me about a plan I'd been involved in Northern Australia, looking, and they'd noted that in the common taxonomy we've been looking at weed species. And they were wanting to get in touch and have a look at sort of what types of weeds, and they were doing a global analysis, looking at what's happening in these areas, looking at what people saw as the drivers, what actions they're taking. So I think that's probably, for us, one of the really exciting things. And it means we are able to go and talk with others and really think about what we're doing. But the other thing which I think has been critical, and you can't read the writing in all these things, it's basically a fairly basic adaptive project management step. But under the second step, the first step is selecting the people and actually thinking about your scope, how do you, your area is, what it is you're trying to conserve. But in the second step, there's an area where I think, in a sense, we often gloss over it, and it's really thinking not just about, okay, now I know what it is I'm interested in, what are the threats to it? It's actually stopping and saying, if these are the things I'm interested in, what are the things that are really, you know, what am I going to hypothesise are the things which are really important for its long-term viability? And then thinking about how do the threats which I know are there, how do those impact on those things which I've hypothesised are the most important for its long-term viability? And that creates a point where we're thinking about climate change for us also to start thinking about what is it about climate change that we actually think is going to have the most impact on that viability. And I think, Peter, that goes back to some of the points you were making, but I think also some of the points that came up in the LGA talk. So starting to try and really pinpoint what it is, and I think that's for Greening Australia where we're going to come out with the most interesting questions, where we will interact with the research community on what it is we need to know. So I talked a little bit about this. So, we now talk about transforming our landscape system, our major program, which is shorthand for making tangible improvements. And it's pretty important here to flag that one of the things we look at is we don't just look at biodiversity, but we have a fairly strong focus on thinking about sustainable livelihoods at the same time, because we found that unless we're talking with the people in our landscapes about things which matter to them, we've used a shorthand of livelihoods, it can become much more difficult to get things. This map sort of starts showing you some of the areas we've started picking out. You may notice there's a circle in the same place as one of the areas in Great Eastern Ranges, so we have been involved in that project in one area. I'm not going to talk about that today. I thought it might be useful just to quickly run through a bit of a case study of some of the work we've been doing around Boorowa. And just starting to think about how that all fits in. We've actually done a number of projects in the Boorowa area, and to some extent they've been dictated by what you might call fashion in government funding. So we had a really interesting project called the Salt Shaker Project some years ago when salinity was in fashion, but was about remnant protection and remnant expansion. That had a really great element where we did a lot of work around bird movement, thinking about connectivity. We've had now for a number of years a project called River Recovery in Boorowa. Again, with a focus on looking at restoration of these sort of areas. And interestingly, over five, this is one we've managed to keep going over 5 years, and the list of people and dot points there are all the different people who've been involved in supplying funding for that. So you can see, in a way, it's taken a lot of small pieces, but we've made a relatively large quilt over that period. So the blue bits is where there was vegetation cover, and the red bits is where we've managed to re-establish some vegetation cover. But in thinking about that, and thinking about what's needed for the landscape, we've actually looked at it and thought a lot more about, you know, for a whole of landscape connectivity or whole of landscape repair, we need whole of community approaches. We've been quite successful in terms of remnant protection. We've been very successful in terms of helping put in fairly narrow windbreaks and corridors. We've started doing quite a lot of riparian restoration. Again, started to do a bit in the sort of peri-urban area, but we had a sort of quite large area, so particularly around Boorowa, where we really weren't making much impact, and which was probably the area which was most disconnected. So we came up with a fabulous acronym, and I do like that you actually get... I had the fundraiser for the Australian Museum come up to me and say, "Oh, you're from Greening Australia. Whopper's great." I was going, "Not a fundraiser from the Australian Museum. Know about Wolf." And it turned out that her dad actually had the first site that we put in for what is really called whole of paddock restoration. And we've looked at this as a possible way of looking at carbon farming, but it's also closely related to people's pasture cropping systems. And it fills a gap in the landscape which we were having a lot of difficulty getting traction in before. We used to get these sorts of changes. And what we're doing is set up a program where we said, look, we want a minimum of 10 hectares, which we thought was pretty ambitious for most landowners. It was a lot larger area than we're typically getting with them. Well, as it turned out, we've got an average of sort of 20 to 40 hectares in the program. We're doing widely spaced direct seeding belts on the contours with a range of native trees and shrubs, mostly looking for paddocks where you've got a degree of resilience in the ground layer already. And the big thing we do is we've cut down the cost because we've said we don't want to do any fencing, because fencing was the highest cost in any of our efforts. So it's brought the cost down to $750 a hectare. Now that might sound a little bit high, but what that incorporates in it is an annual payment to landowners, which means they actually keep sheep or cattle out of the paddock for 7 years. So things get a chance to get up and away. And you also get, and this has been one of the biggest things for a lot of the landowners enrolled in the program, is their native pasture just rockets ahead. And so they suddenly see that there's, you know, pastures which they saw as very non-productive, they actually start looking at with quite different eyes. So we think this has been quite a good program. We're looking to roll it out nationally. But I guess for us, this has been one of those ways of thinking about, you know, shifting in scale. The biggest question for us is, how do you shift in scale from the sort of work we've been doing at the sort of cost we've been doing it to a different scale, which is likely to give us the scale of impact we're likely to need? Well, that's probably useful just to say research does underpin and improve our work. So, for example, in relation to direct seeding, we're doing a trial at the moment with our Capital Region Office where we're looking at improvements to seed survival and germination through the use of seed coatings. So particularly looking at dealing with issues of ant predation, so just kind of gobble stuff up. Because one of the biggest costs in direct seeding is actually getting the seed, the amount of seed you need. You use a lot more seed direct seeding than you do hand planting things. And often in landscapes where there's not a lot of seed. But what we've also been looking at is actually putting the coating on and the type of coating, so that what we're doing is actually delaying germination until there's sufficient soil moisture, particularly for eucalypts. So we're sort of a year and a half into that. We've had fairly good results so far, but we'll probably have some better thoughts on that a little bit later. We've also done things like measurement of sequestration across a lot of our plantings. We actually were very fortunate. We were funded by CS Energy and able to spend $1 million going back and visiting plantings that we put in over the last 15 years and taking a look at what they were sequestering and looking at that and having a look at how that actually related to some of the national data sets. And interestingly, there's quite a big difference because typically they're planting species that aren't in forestry models, whereas they make forestry assumptions. We're starting to do quite a bit of assessment of sequestration potential at specific sites for things like the mining industry and water utilities, where what they're looking at doing is potentially expanding the amount of restoration they do if they can find an additional way of funding it, or potentially they're looking at expanding the range of species they put in. So that, I think that's quite an interesting one for us at the future. And I put this one in. We've also been talking with University of Western Sydney and the Botanic Gardens about doing something perhaps a little bit similar in New South Wales, which is looking at environmental performance of different species across gradients, so that we can actually think about what are we putting in, are there going to be differences. And this is one of those really hard things, because you're looking at such a small range of species and you're going to have a long time, and I keep wondering whether this is a window we should be looking through. My conclusion is we do need to look through some of these windows, but one of the big things for an organisation like Green in Australia is trying to make choices about the research we get involved in. The other thing I'll just touch on is funding, which I call the key constraint for addressing this. And really, we look at it and say there's government programs, philanthropic donations, there's corporate social responsibility type programs from companies, and then there's things like ecosystem service markets. And I think at the moment, the fourth dot point is the area which is really underexplored, and in terms of policy, something which is reasonably urgent to start thinking about. There's a big opportunity here, and a big opportunity, we think, for it to deliver multiple environmental and social outcomes. Now, there is a kind of interesting question about whether it goes down a forestry pathway and becomes very speculative, like some of the plantation forests, and that perhaps won't have such a happy outcome. But I think there's a big sort of policy driver to start looking at how you actually integrate it with multiple outcomes. But just sort of some of our back of the envelope things is you look at it and you say, even with a sort of taking a modest share of what might happen, potentially you're looking at funding, putting back vegetation across something like 500,000 hectares a year, which would be quite significant. We've looked at putting together a standard. This causes much agony and possibly much need for future research inside Green Australia, because you start saying to yourself, if you start doing these activities, it's the question about what are you putting where, what impacts does it have, and how do you decide how to do it? And the biggest thing is looking at the sort of capitalisation that's required. Currently, just so people are aware, we're not doing a lot of carbon plantings in New South Wales. We've focused on plantings in Gondwana Link and Habitat 141, two large-scale initiatives that we're involved in Victoria and South Australia for Habitat 141 and Western Australia for Gondwana Link. One of the reasons we've done that is we've actually purchased land in cooperation with others in those areas, and that enables us to do a lot of experimentation and also to be very clear about kind of our long-term research. And really what we're looking at now is whether we can secure what we call the large baseload customer, which would allow us to expand probably to another 6 to 8 landscapes across the country and put in place similar things, but sort of an active time of looking at sort of what sort of joint venture arrangements we can do, where government R&D might fit into that, and whether we can actually construct some kind of business and philanthropy hybrid, because the business case, I've had to go into doing a lot of things like looking at net present value modelling and things like this to see whether we can get business to invest in this, but it almost always needs a kickstart first. That's sort of where Green in Australia is, and I just put that up, that sort of some of our WA plantings are sort of coloured by this carbon. One of the areas we'd like to be in. So thank you very much.